So with that introductory reading, we'll call upon our brother Clyde to continue his series on the Ten Commandments.
Well, good evening, everyone. I actually considered sitting tonight, but then I decided to stand. I've had a back problem for, goes back 6 or 8 weeks. And standing's fine. Sitting's fine. It's in between. That's the problem. So I thought that I'd better stand because I was a bit concerned that maybe you would have thought that I couldn't stand talking to you. So I'm going to stand. You'll get that. So what I'd like to do tonight is to do kind of a simple review of where we were. This is going to be fun. My printer didn't work either today, so I haven't got all my printing done here, but that's okay. Don't worry about that. So we have kind of a simple topic, which most of us who've been reading the Bible all our life would say, oh, Ten Commandments, so we get that. This morning, I had a call from, Evelyn had a call from our oldest son who said that he could talk to me, but he didn't have a lot of time. And after about 40 minutes, he went through the whole Ten Commandments thing. So what are you going to tell him? Are you going to tell him that there's a rabbinical version of the Ten Commandments? Are you going to tell him that there's a Catholic version of the Ten Commandments? Are you going to tell him this or that? I only got two nights and I've done one night, so I can't really tell you what I'm going to say. No point discussing that. But it is a very simple topic. We found that the Ten Commandments before were put down, truncated into two commandments. We'll have a look at that to begin with tonight. I'm going to spend a little bit of time reviewing that. And then we're going to proceed for a bit to try and unpack the first five commandments. I think we got kind of into the first couple, but we'll spend a few minutes trying to unpack those. And then we'll spend some time reviewing the specific references to the Ten Commandments in the New Testament. And so I think this is important because we might say, well, it doesn't lay the Ten Commandments out like Sean read from Exodus. So maybe they're not in there. And of course, nothing could be further from the truth. And I think we spend a little time maybe with the 10, and you've come with, go like this, with some comments and verses to put in there. And also the fifth commandment, which is, honor your father and mother, that Paul says to the Ephesians, because it's the only one that comes with a promise that you may live long in the land. So we want to have a look at what are those qualities, what are those events in our life, in the family, that can provide us with attributes that are not only family building, but community building, and further from an Israeli point of view, nation building. Now, so this is up there. There's an amazing simplicity in this question, and it is a question. It was asked by a lawyer. It was answered by Jesus. Now, we've been spending a lot of time recently talking about how we can communicate with questions and answers. And one thing I learned from spending 10,000 hours in the college classroom, that if you're going to get, and you're going to hope to get, an answer that has a meaning and a learning outcome, you better ask the question properly, simply, so that it's well understood. If you get a good, clear question, you can better be prepared for a good, simple, clear answer. So here it is. The question is, by the lawyer, teacher, what is the great commandment in the law? Pretty simple, pretty straightforward. Most Jewish people in the day would understand exactly what was being said. And Jesus said to him, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and all your mind. That's the first and great. And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these, he says, two commandments depend all the law and the prophets. And I often wondered why, and I'll give you my testimony again, we don't ask those questions and all the questions simple so that they're understandable. Like when I applied for baptism in October 1962, to the old Kings Road community, I was asked to come to, what do they call it? What do they call it?
An examination, interview.
Okay. An interview, which generally is a whole bunch of questions. And looking back, I'm often wondering why they didn't just ask this question. So applied, do you love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind and all your strength and your neighbor as yourself? Yes or no? So yes or no? No would have been my answer. Would have had to have been. To be honest, I'd have to say no. What do you mean no? You can't come in here and say, no, you don't love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind, your neighbor as yourself. What do you love? I don't know, myself, I guess. I was 17. You can't just love yourself. What else do you love? Evelyn. I loved Evelyn. And by the way, I still do. More. So what's wrong with a question like that? It's certainly definitive. It would bring about an answer that would be easy to understand and to work with. But no, that's not the way it went, of course. I was ushered into a very well-appointed upscale home in a dimly lit sitting room. And attending were three uncles. Well, I was a Christadelphian kid, so everybody that was not in my family immediately was an uncle. And if they were married, they were aunts. So they spent an hour and a half asking me questions. So they thought. And after an hour and a half and frustration, they retired to an adjoining room to discuss the outcome of this. I waited for 30 minutes. For somebody to come back. I thought they'd all gone home. They came back and the senior uncle said, well, Clydie, you know, we had to think very seriously about whether we were going to pass you. And I was thinking, well, was it 50% to pass? Or you didn't tell me that. Well, we just didn't think you were able to answer the questions. And I thought to myself, because you don't dare speak up, I'm not sure you were asking me any questions. I couldn't understand a question out of the whole hour and a half. So couldn't answer a question. So then one of the brethren that was there, one of the uncles that was there said, we passed you, Clydie, because you were in my Sunday school class, and I know you know all the answers. Because in my Sunday school class, you must know all the answers. Which, again, was not particularly a great way of doing things. Simple, clear questions bring about, hopefully, simple, clear answers. Now, of course, it wasn't my fault. It never was. But that's the way it turned out. And that's not really the way we should be doing things. Because questions that are based on faith are important, obviously. And this particular question is, as we said 2 months ago now, is all-encompassing. It needs a yes or a no answer. When you think about it, it's kind of overwhelming. It can be overpowering. It's exhaustive because once you've said that, you've really said everything. Comprehensive. So we also discussed the priority of these commandments. And Moses is quite clear that these commandments were for your children. He didn't say to necessarily to the people, he said to your children, the doorposts of your house on your gates for the family and the city, that is where the commandments need to be. Starting with the home, with the parents, with the family, and with the city. The thing is that if you build good families, you can build good communities, you can build good cities, and you can build good nations. This is fundamental. And the delineation of these commandments are set forth essentially in the Ten Commandments. The Law of Moses was how the Ten were to be applied and how they were defined in practice. So here's really the fundamental foundational principle. We have to say when we think about this that this commandment comes in context. So what is the context of this commandment?
Sorry, is that rhetorical or is that a question?
What is the context of this commandment? Well, I'm not doing very well here, am I?
Egypt had lots of gods.
Where were they? Where were the people?
Wilderness. So they left Egypt.
Right, they were in the wilderness, but where were they?
In slavery.
In slavery, right? This is the context, isn't it? This commandment was given to them against the backdrop of the fact that the Lord your God brought you out of the land of Egypt and out of the house of slavery. Let's not forget that. Egypt had some pretty good stuff, but there were slaves there. Which is going to be important when he starts talking about giving him a day off. There was a big change that had taken place here. So when they looked at life, they needed to see life in terms of the Lord, their God, who brought them out of the house of slavery. Why would you need any other gods before me? The sad thing, of course, was that Egypt had 2,000 gods. 2,000 gods. So this was definitive. This was the Lord who brought them out of the land of Egypt, the land of 2,000 gods, and out of the house of slavery, and was going to take them to the promised land. Number one. Number two. So if you had come from Egypt, where there was an endless plethora of gods of all descriptions and sizes, of animals, of birds and everything that you can imagine out of creation, the stars of heaven, 2,000 different gods, they all had to be put into some type of image so that people could worship them or relate to them, some type of likeness. So it's clear that if you have one God in heaven that brought you out of Egypt, you can't have 2,000 gods that you've made with your own hands. Because, well, some of them were pretty good. They were made out of stone and so on, with gold and silver and jewels and so on, carved images. You can't go having a bunch of gods. Because you have a God that created you and brought you out of the house of slavery. So don't do it. Now, this third one is the business of taking the name of the Lord your God in vain. And God not holding you guiltless. And I think it's in Leviticus 24, verse 30 or 17, maybe, where there's a punishment laid out for blasphemy. Now, blasphemy really covered any type of thing that you said that was in vain, which would be in light speaking or in jest or just out of saying something. And the punishment was death, which seemed pretty extreme. Really, I think today we would find that to be pretty extreme. But remember that these laws at this point in time when Moses was writing hadn't really been kind of codified and results of punishments and so on, penalties laid out. So they find some kid who's in a scuffle out in the wilderness compound. And he's an Israelite kid. Well, his mom was an Israelite. His mom was a saint. She was part of the tribe of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Her God was the God who had redeemed them from slavery, brought them out of Egypt. Her God was a God that was taking her to the promised land. But his dad was an Egyptian. Leviticus chapter 24 and 10, if you want to follow the text. His dad was an Egyptian who believed in 2,000 gods. So, you know, give me a break. It's only throwing one name around. His dad had 2,000 cuss words. So for the kid, I guess it was no big deal. It was just saying something in jest or in vain or in anger. Now, the Israelite's woman's son, whose father was an Egyptian, went out among the people of Israel, and the Israelite woman's son and a man of Israel fought in the camp, and the Israelite's woman's son blasphemed the name and cursed. Then they brought him to Moses. His mother's name was Shemaleth, the daughter of Dibri, of the tribe of Dan. And they put him in custody until they could find out what the will of the Lord was in relation to this offense. They had a discussion, a deliberation about it. Then they took him out and stoned him to death. Which, you know, I guess for most of us who have been raised in the liberality of the West, this seems like it's extremely harsh. If I ask for a show of hands, I'm not going to, but you might all agree with me that this seems really harsh. But remember, these are important moments, because if you say, don't take the name of the Lord your God in vain, and people go, well, whatever. You say, instead, don't take the name of the Lord your God in vain, because if you do, you're going to die. And this, of course, was something that happened in the New Testament with Ananias and Sapphira. They were selling property, and they decided to come in with a false number for what they'd sold their property for. And they could have told them the truth and said, we decided to keep some back for ourselves, but they lied to the Holy Spirit, and they both of them dropped dead. And that, of course, is an extremely important moment in the early church, because these people were selling their stuff and bringing it in and forming communities. And you just had to take these things serious, because it was all happening under the auspices of the Holy Spirit. So they died. And of course, if you were a little Hebrew lady and you married an Egyptian, there could be some repercussions from that. I heard a story recently of a little girl who went to her mother, who was a good Christian lady. Her dad was an atheist. Yeah, her dad was an atheist. She said to her mother, so mommy, where did we come from? And her mother said, well, sweetheart, we came from God. God made us, and he created us in his own image because he loves us. And so she thought, well, that's great. So she goes then to her dad, and she says to her dad, Daddy, mommy said that we came from God. And God created us because he loves us. And her dad said, get a life, girl. Your mother's a nut. We don't come from God. We came from the apes and the monkeys. Which messed her mind up a bit. And so she went back to her mother subsequently and said, Mommy, Daddy said, you're wrong. He said, we don't come from God. We come from the apes and the monkeys. You've heard this before, have you? Okay. So her mom said, well, dear, that's true. The family has come from the apes and the monkeys, but that's all on your father's side, right? Yeah. So it's not a good situation. It's really what we're saying. And this was another issue here that the Israelites had to sort through, because as a lot of Egyptians came out, there was a mixed multitude. And so here they were. And the lesson was that you don't take the name of the Lord your God in vain. You know, there's power in his name. And if we make a little short list here about the name of God and what it means and what the Bible tells us about that, it's 1 Samuel 17:45, and you don't have time to look all these up. There's power in the name. There's protection in the name. Proverbs 18:10. There's provision in his name. You need to kind of keep the two ideas in mind. The 2,000 gods of Egypt who did nothing, said nothing, saw nothing, heard nothing. And the great I Am, the God of Israel. There's praise in his name. Psalm 8:34 and so on. And above all that, there is a name, Ephesians 1:20-21, that is above every name that is named. And that is the name of Jesus. So this is something that is clearly awesome, and we should be taking it with great care. So number four is remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. But the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. On it you shall do no work. You shall not do any work. You or your son or your daughter, your male servant or your female servant, or your livestock, your sojourner who lives among you, and in your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the seventh day and made it holy. So the context here is that God created the earth in 6 days. He worked for 6 days and he rested on the seventh day, which really is the model now of civilization. God made us, he understood us, and he offered us a day off, which they didn't get in Egypt, as we've already said. Very few of them anyway. They worked 7 days a week. But God, the God of Israel, offered a day off. He did that because he knew that that's what we need. That's the rhythm of life that he set up. And if we work 7 days a week, it becomes a problem. So take a day off. And again, there was a Sabbath breaker. And the Sabbath breaker was executed. While the people of Israel were in the wilderness, they found a man gathering sticks on the Sabbath day. Seems relatively harmless enough. And those who found him gathering sticks brought him to Moses and Aaron, to all the congregation, and put him in custody because it had not been made clear at this time just what happened when people broke the Sabbath and brought it before the Lord. And the Lord said to Moses, take him outside the camp and stone him to death. So again, here's another one of these great moments where everybody stood back and in awe. What? He died because he was picking up sticks on the Sabbath? And I don't know, he probably needed to make some food, or he was cold or something. But no, he worked. He worked on the Sabbath. And I wonder how we put that into our perspective to say, why did the Lord mandate a day off? Saying, make it holy, which meant make it separate. The only thing you do is worship. That's it. Why did he mandate this day? And in our particular world in which we live, if God didn't create a sort of make some importance over it, we would work, or we would play pickleball, or we would play soccer, or we would do this or that. We'd travel, or we would, you know, hike, or all sorts of things that we could do. We'd fill the day up. We might even go to church two or three times a day, which is work in itself, actually. It's activity and work in itself. So we cut off the very day that the Lord gave us because he knows that we need the time off. We would fill it up. So there's sort of a sense of awe. Don't do anything. And when we were kids, my mom and dad kind of had that kind of a Christian Sabbath idea. You go to the meeting, but you don't do anything else. So all the kids on the street, they played baseball, and they were in leagues. Now, happily for me, I couldn't play baseball or any sport, so I got to say, no, can't play baseball on the Sabbath. My brother was much better at it, so he had a bit of more of a problem with it. But here again, there's that sense that it's not just that we honor God on that day, but we have a rest. And that's why it says in Mark 2:27, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. Which the Pharisees, by Jesus' day, got this thing flipped up so that they had the Sabbath and all the rules of the Sabbath, and then mankind had to fit into that, which was really not what God intended. The Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. So the Son of Man is the Lord of the Sabbath. What does that mean for us? So the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath.
The purpose of the Sabbath was for the benefit of people, so to release them from their bondage. In the context of leaving Egypt, that's what it represented, a release.
And a big change.
A big change.
In the work week, yep.
And it was supposed to teach that you have 6 days where you focus on, as it were, yourself, you know, the very necessary things of life, and a dedicated day where you're not thinking about yourself, but others.
Now, ultimately, we see from Mark 2:27, the Sabbath was not made, was made for man, not man for the Sabbath, and the Son of Man is the Lord of the Sabbath. So, how do we see that now projecting into what Jeremy has just said? I think we could go a little bit farther than that by saying, yes, and it's all about Jesus. Now, we could maybe discuss that after, but actually, brothers and sisters, it's all about Jesus, even the Sabbath. So, okay, let's move on. I don't trust this thing here, but we'll see. Now, this is the one. Honor your father and mother that your days may be long in the land. And we pick up in the 6th chapter of Ephesians, verse 1, where Paul says to the Ephesians, this is actually an answer to the second question that we have, that can you find these things in the New Testament? And here's Paul in Ephesus, and it's largely an Asian Gentile country city, but lots of Jews around because they had a big synagogue there. This is the first commandment with a promise, which is that your days may be long in the land. So if you honor your father and mother, there's all kinds of benefits that flow from this, including long life in your land, which also means, I guess, on the other side of that, that if you don't, you're not going to be in the land very long. That's fair enough to say that. Any thoughts about things we can learn in the home, benefits from the home, anything about this model of the home, mother and father, which are beneficial to family building, society building, city building, and country building. So first of all, kind of sort of a hierarchical honor, which is useful in other situations in life. And from that relationship and those relationships, talents that can move us forward, okay?
I think
family education in the family.
Yep, and also dealing with discipline and guidance and setting boundaries and rules.
And that's a big statement right now, because the Western world in which we live is doing everything it can to take our children away from us and make them wards of the state and or the school system. And they're getting really, really aggressive about this. Break up the family, and let the government decide what's good for your kids. That's not answering my question. Any other questions? Any other answers to this? Okay, so the problem is that you have to have parents that you can honor, was your first point.
Well, it would seem that that's logical, but the commandment doesn't specify.
It's not talking about the parents. It's talking about the children. Okay. And what do you do if you have a parent that is nuts? Well, I don't think that gives the child an option. That would be my answer to that. I think we have to, it's assumed, I guess, that the parents are honorable. That's an assumption in this commandment.
Because it was given to the Israelites who were living under the law of Moses.
Yeah, so there's an assumption that's true. That doesn't hold true today because, we were talking about my students, early students, there's only half of them that had parents, you know, two-parent families. So that was 25, 30 years ago. We were already in big trouble because the number of families that had broken down and only had one parent or mixed parents was already well on its way to doom. Any other questions? Any other answers here? So, Stephen.
Interesting. And I would juxtapose the idea that it's interesting that Jackson, there is no sense of whether the parents were honorable or not.
So, if we're told also in Genesis we're going to have to get out, then we better get what we need essentially before we get out. That's hopefully the way that is. So that also, I'm just going to have to throw this in here because I personally didn't have a perfect father. Did I just say that? You probably didn't either. But he was a good father. And there's negative and positive things that you learn. But in any case, the obligation of the child is to honor the father. So you learn from that, and that sort of gets back to what we've been saying about leaving the house eventually with the tools that you need. Any other comments there?
Today, society is made it hard for children to move out. You know, they're not maybe 18, they're told not to go to school, but, you know, for that comment, it's really hard today for kids to move out at 18, you know, stay home longer. Because just cost of living and cost of apartments and stuff is insane.
Well, our society today clearly is completely counterproductive to family and honoring the family. Now, whether we go off to school in grade one or grade two, where our kids are already in big trouble. So I'm just going to complete my list because I didn't come, as they say, listless. A child gets his concept, his or her, their concept of gender in the home. This is huge. because it's such a big, crazy issue. It's one of the things that Stephen was talking to me about today in his university classrooms. It's insanity in a school where you're supposed to be into science, right? Child gets his concept of gender in the home. Child gets his understanding of private property from the home. If I'm wrong, just speak out. But I think that's like if I took my brother's toy, he'd beat me up, right? So there's a sense of that's mine and this is yours. Sense of private property from the home. The child gets a sense of himself at home. He's a member of a family. And he fits in with the various benefits of the family. A child gets a concept of life in the home, how life goes. You know, you get up and you eat and you prepare food and you have shelter and you do things as a family, a community. And that's a concept that is one of the things that when you leave, you really need to get that down. How does life work? What are the things you have to do to stay alive and to stay well? And we already had this one here. A child gets a concept of discipline in the home. And there's discipline because there's a mother and father and there's other siblings. So you're learning how to get by in life, as in the previous comment. A child gets this concept of discipline in the home. A child can receive an understanding of love in the home. That's really the best place to sort that out in the mind of a child. I suggest to you what love is all about. A child can receive a godly education in the home. A child can receive a sense of healing in the home. So I think we've probably said enough, but we can see the importance of this fifth commandment and how that it can be so fundamental to life. And as Stephen said, even the future in the kingdom, because it's all based upon this model. Any questions before we move on? Good. All right, your verses. Ten Commandments are not specifically delineated in the New Testament. Have you got a verse, New Testament verse, that says, no other gods before me? One God, no other gods before me. 1 Timothy 2:5. Do you want to read that, please?
So there's one God and one mediator also between God and man, Christ Jesus.
Okay. That's pretty clear. Any others? I mean, if we can find one, we're doing good here because I don't think we've got a lot of time. But so that's a very good one. I had 1 Corinthians 8, verse 6. And oh, 1 Timothy 2, 5 and 6. One God and so on. So that's a good one for that. Pretty definitive. Do not make idols. And I'm going to read that time. Right. So that takes us back to Egypt, doesn't it? All the images and creations and graven images, molten images, and so on. All right. Any other ones that you have for do not make idols? First John 5 and 21, little children, keep yourselves from idols. I think that's relevant here. Any other thoughts? Verses?
Well, when Paul was at the Areopagus, he spoke to them about their particular idol to the unknown God. I mean, that's a sort of a different kind of concept, but still.
It's an anti-idol.
He made it about God, the real God.
Paul and Mars Hill. Okay.
Romans
1:23. Do you want to read it, Stephen?
And exchange the glory of the immortal God for the immortal man.
Right. Exchanging the glory of God for images and animals and creeping things. And Commandment number 3. Do not misuse the name of the Lord.
12, verse 31.
Matthew 12:31. Read it.
For I send you, all manner of sin and blasphemy shall be forgiven unto men, but the blasphemy against the Holy Spirit shall not be forgiven unto men. Whosoever speaketh word against the Son of Man, it shall be forgiven, but whosoever speaketh against the Holy Spirit, it shall not be forgiven, neither in this world, neither in the world.
Okay, so now we have a specific reference to blasphemy in relation to misuse. I didn't get that one, but so that's a good one. Yeah. Do not misuse the name of the Lord. Do not blaspheme the name of the Lord. Any others?
Matthew 12.
31 and 32. Do not misuse the name of the Lord. Now, does anyone have anything here on this one? Other than 1 Timothy 6, 1 to 2.
They accused him of essentially claiming himself to be as God. He said he's the Son of God. So they were essentially using this law against what Christ was saying. And so it's kind of like the inverse of
right.
They misunderstood what it was to misuse the name of the Lord.
Okay, Jesus calling himself the Son of God. Right. Okay, anything else? So I have 1 Timothy 6, 1 and 2. So let all who are under the yoke of bond servants regard their own masters as worthy of honor. So this comes back to this hierarchical thing of honoring our masters so that the name of God and the teachings may not be reviled. So if you don't honor your master or your boss and revile them, this is very similar to this concept of reviling God and misusing the name of the Lord. I'm not sure I've ever called a boss a bad name, but I've been a boss and probably been called a bad name. So it's a sense of reviling and just ignoring the value of a person in authority. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Now there's a number of ways that we could look at this. Some thoughts? New Testament, remember the Sabbath day? Okay, that was Mark 2. Sabbath was made for man, not man for Sabbath, and Jesus is the Lord of the Sabbath. And I have here, there are many references to the Sabbath day in the New Testament, including assumption that Jews under the law in the time of Christ would be observing the Sabbath. But there's no direct or indirect command for believers in the church age to observe the Sabbath as a day of rest or of worship. And I think in the New Testament, this is true. You won't find that set out. Of course, we've moved beyond the specific seventh day to a life as represented by Christ. It's now all about Jesus. Okay, Colossians 2:16 releases the believers from the Sabbath rule. It wasn't that it wasn't important. It just had a fuller meaning, didn't it? Jesus, the Lord of the Sabbath, has become for us our Sabbath rest, according to Hebrews chapter 1 and verse 11. So the Sabbath wasn't done away with. The principle of it was there, and it lived on. Therefore, let no one pass judgment on you in questions of food and drink or with regard to a festival or a new moon or a Sabbath. These are a shadow of the things to come, but the substance belongs to Christ. So the Sabbath, at the end of the day, was all about Jesus. And so that's how we see the Sabbath. And here's getting back to the future of all of this. For if Joshua had given them rest, God would not have spoken of another day later on. So then there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. For whoever has entered God's rest has also rested from his works as God did from his. So we work as human beings, doing our own work, but we need to rest from our work and do the Lord's work. And in the end, there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. Any other comments on the Sabbath?
I hope in some respect, I think that we
Yes, that's the other piece of it, isn't it? It's the future piece of it. But that doesn't absolve us of getting our own work out of the way and concentrating. Yeah. So we're going to move on. Honor your father and mother. This is the one we've already looked at, so I throw this one up. Ephesians 6, 1 to 3. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother. This is the first commandment with a promise. And if you do, then it'll go well with you, and you'll live long in the land. Any other New Testament references to honoring father and mother?
Colossians 3:20.
Read it, please.
Children, obey your parents in all things, for this is well pleasing unto the Lord.
Okay. Any others? All right, number 6, do not murder.
Not just, you were told not to do not murder, but I say, do you have any anger with this?
Which was Matthew 5 and, sorry?
21 to 22.
Matthew 5 and 21 to 22. So, yes, that's do not murder. But it's more than that.
Yeah.
It's more than that, which is what we find in the New Testament so often, that the law itself is that, you know, you don't go killing somebody. But you don't even think about it. So I think this is how it works out in the New Testament. Any other verses? Do not murder.
1 John 3:15.
Yeah.
Everyone who hates his brother is a murderer. You know that no murderer has a life.
Right. And that follows from what Mike was saying about that. So yes, I have Romans 3:8-10. Owe no one anything except to love one another, for the one that loves another has fulfilled the law. For the commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder. This is specifically what we pulled out here. Not steal and so on. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. And of course, if you love your neighbor as yourself, you don't kill him. Love does no wrong to neighbor, and so on. Any other verses? You should not murder. Do we have a Zoom community here?
Yeah.
Wait, did I invite them to throw in their verses?
Yeah, they can.
It's a bit late, but they certainly can be happy to do so. Adultery. Number 7, not commit adultery. Well, it's mentioned in 1 Corinthians 6:9 with a list of other things that are also in the Ten Commandments. So it's certainly there. Any other verses that anyone has?
Well, I had the one documented on Matthew, but sort of like murder and anger.
Adulterous, right. So it's listed with others like this one is. Any other verses? Matthew 5 and 27. Can you read that, Bob?
You have heard that it was said, do not commit adultery, but I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart.
Right. So this is the same context of murder by thought, right? So it moves away from the legal aspects of things to the spiritual aspects of things. And, you know, people think, oh, well, these things aren't mentioned in the New Testament, but nothing's changed, really. In fact, it's amped up to a higher level, isn't it? It's not just the physical act. Do not steal. I had Ephesians 4:28, let the thief no longer steal, but rather let him labor. Any other thoughts? New Testament, do not steal. Well, at least you're still working on this.
Do not steal kind of looks, to do not covet, doesn't it? Because it's the internal motivator.
Right.
And when we get to do not covet, it's now looking inward. Of course, I'm kind of jumping the gun here, but.
Okay. Matthew 19, do you want to look that up, Mike? 18. Matthew 19 and 18?
18. Clyde, you've got 6 mentioned in Mark 10, 17. You've got 6 commandments mentioned by Christ.
Mark 10.
Mark 10, 17 to 20.
6 commandments, okay.
And Mark 19, one just does us the, he said to him, which ones you should want to commit murder, you should not commit adultery, you should not steal, you should not, which is the 12th.
Okay. Mention there, not steal.
1 Corinthians
6, 10.
Thieves is in the list of those that.
Thieves. Right. Okay, it's probably just as well that we didn't invite the Zoomers in at the beginning. It could have been a long night. But anyway, that's great. We can hear what they're saying. That's wonderful. Do not give false testimony. We've got to wrap this up. We won't be invited back if we don't. False testimony, Revelations 21:8, all liars. Now, I think we can find, again, this concept embedded in the text. God is not happy with false speakers and liars. Do not covet. And, you know, it's often said that do not covet, really, if we looked at the Ten Commandments as the top 5, sounds like a golf term, actually, in the bottom 5, that the ones at the top are about loving God, and the bottom 5 are about loving the neighbor, and the top of the top 5 is thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind. And the bottom one is thou shalt not covet. But the thing is that covetousness really covers the whole bottom 5. If you think about this, put to death therefore what is earthly in you, sexual immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, and covetousness. Because covetousness is passion. It's evil desire when you desire something someone else has. And covetousness covers this sin. This is idolatry, on account of which the wrath of God is coming. So I might just make some quick final comments about covetousness, because I think we need to end here with the magnitude of this particular commandment. Covetousness goes beyond lawful and legitimate desire. Just because we look at something doesn't mean to say we're coveting it. It's when we go beyond legal and legitimate desire. Covetousness has an appetite that is never satisfied. It's not like getting the new pickup, it's getting the next one, the better one, right? Never satisfied. People do that. Covetousness is deceptive, it's debasing, and it's destructive. You don't have time to debate these. Covetousness is no minor sin. It challenges all the first 9. Every one of them, when we think about it, challenges every one of them. So the question then is, simple question, what is the secret to satisfaction? We think that coveting is the secret to satisfaction, wanting things. It isn't. This is the verse that I have, the anti-covetousness verse, that is kind of a wrap to what I want to say. Godliness with contentment is great gain. We brought nothing into the world, and we cannot take anything out of the world. But if we have food and clothing, with these we will be content. But those who desire to be rich and fall into temptation, into a snare, into many senseless and harmful desires, and that plunge people into ruin and destruction, for the love of money is the root of all kinds of evils. It is through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pangs. So what is the secret of satisfaction? Godliness, with contentment, and in that there is great gain.